So it's now my pleasure to talk to you about ambulatory surgery. We've talked about triage and identifying patients that might be appropriate for outpatient care. We've talked about children, we've talked about wound management, and we've talked about following those patients in telemedicine. But now you get to a point where you either have to fish or cut bait, and you have to decide, am I going to operate on these patients or not? So first of all, I don't have any disclosures to make. I will be mentioning a number of different products. I don't have any financial associations with those. These are intended only as examples and not as recommendations. My apologies if I don't include every single possible version of those products. First of all, we're going to talk about why we should worry about trying to do burn surgery as an ambulatory procedure. And then we'll talk about the patient selection and preoperative planning that needs to go into that. We're going to focus mainly on the operative technical challenges that we have to address to do that, and then a little bit about the clinical management that's associated with the post-graft management of these individuals. Instead of talking about why, I thought I'd first talk about why not. Like, it's easier to do as inpatients. You know what? They're in a bed. I can control the environment. I know that they're not going to go do something like, you know, rip their dressings off, or I know the nurses will take care of them. And if there's a complication, like they're getting cellulitis or infection, hey, someone's going to tell me. I'm going to order some antibiotics, and I know they're going to take it. And some of us in teaching institutions occasionally have residents that will say, you know what? This is what's happening. So you know what's happening. Well, you know, frankly, I think ambulatory surgery is actually better for the patient. You know, inpatient care may be better for us, but overall, it reduces the resources needed for patients. I'm a Canadian. In our situation, we're always strapped for hospital beds, and routinely we have cases that are canceled because we can't get into the operating room because there's no beds to send the patients afterwards. If you can convert cases to ambulatory surgery, that means that you're now out of that loop and you have access to operative resources that other people are giving up because they can't use those, they don't have a bed. Because of that, I've managed to transfer about 30% of our operative cases for burn care, not just the dressings, but the actual operative care, to an outpatient basis. So that opens up a lot of options for me in terms of trying to take care of them. Then there's the theoretical risks, you know, like the MRSA, the VRE, the C. diff that patients will get, and their concerns about that. And you reduce the risk of exposing your patients to that because they're never on the hospital bed next to the person who you find out later on has steno or acinetobacter or C. diff. There isn't a lot of data on this in the burn literature, but the orthopedic literature talking about individuals that do have high resource surgical procedures, such as ankle fractures and so on, have shown that they can have a 30 to 40% reduction in the costs that are associated with the surgery by transferring the care to ambulatory surgery in the appropriate setting. So how do you do that? You have to choose the right wounds and you have to choose the right patients. The right wound depends on what type of wound it is, the right size of the wound, and the right location for the wound. So I would say that if you have, who here does ambulatory burn surgery currently? Okay, so a lot of you guys are doing this already. If you haven't already, then I think that you should start off with basic thermal wounds. Don't start on the complex electrical or chemical injuries that have tendon exposed or bone exposed first. Those are the ones that you should probably wait until you've had some good success, you've got a system in place that the risks to your patients are reduced before you start to take that up. At our institution, we've safely grafted up to 10% TBSA, depending on the individual, depending on the location, especially if it's a lower extremity, it's a lot better tolerated by patients than it is upper extremity. It does depend on whether or not it's bilateral versus unilateral. Even if it's small areas that are bilateral arms, those individuals will have a lot greater challenge taking care of themselves than the individual with the same total body surface area but on one limb. It's the same thing with legs. If you're operating on both legs, those individuals can't ambulate, they have trouble. So you have to be able to make sure that the resources are in place to help manage them as an outpatient, especially if you're splinting or immobilizing. And one of the biggest challenges with grafting as an outpatient is making sure that you've splinted and immobilized appropriately for the 3 to 5 days that you're going to want to make sure your graft isn't moving around and shearing. These are examples of different wounds that we've managed in terms of grafting as an outpatient, abdomens, legs, arms. Patient selection. This is always a moving target. It really depends on what you have at your local institution and what your guidelines are. Some of our different hospitals that we have in our region will not accept patients that are for a certain BMI just because they don't have the capability in terms of bedding and so on to manage them. The other concern that we're starting to creep into is our anesthetists talk about obstructive sleep apnea. And how many of you have this requirement that if somebody's at risk for OSA, they have to stay in hospital overnight? A few. And that changes what you can do as ambulatory surgery. So in this case, do you need a pre-op anesthesia consult? Is it up to them to decide, you know, we have to figure it out? Sometimes we make sure that we have OTs and PTs that are involved in terms of the management of our patients to make sure they get the appropriate splints created or crutch walking taught and so on. Can they get a spinal? Can they get an epidural? Can you get your anesthetist to use faster anesthetics so you're not giving them a huge full anesthetic? Can you do nerve blocks? All of those things are options that you can need to discuss with the anesthesia team. And today's day and age, one of the fastest growing groups of medications that our patients are on are the anticoagulants. It seems to me like if somebody sneezes funny, they're suddenly put on a NOAC or DOAC. I'm waiting for the next one to come up, which will be the FOAC. I stole this from the British Journal of Hematology. There's multiple different guidelines. You're welcome to choose whichever one your hospital anesthetists want you to use in terms of management of the DOACs and the new anticoagulants. But the basic take-home message in this is that if you're doing a large area and somebody who has, you have a concern for their coagulation status, you do need to consider holding them either a day to 2 days prior to starting on their surgery, depending on whether you consider the way you manage your burn care low-risk bleeding or high-risk bleeding. So that segues nicely into talking about how can you manage that bleeding intraoperatively. And as well as that, what kind of fixation techniques you're going to use and what kind of dressings to use intraoperatively. I went into trauma and burn surgery because I can't stand the sight of blood. It makes me faint. I don't like seeing it, and I think that we need to use whatever techniques we can to avoid that. And whenever I say that to my residents, they all look at me as if I'm crazy, and then they understand that what I'm trying to get at is that we have techniques to prevent blood loss. In modern-day burn surgery, we start to use things like tourniquets to help reduce the bleeding that occurs. There's the use of subcutaneous clysis or insufflation with epinephrine solution. We use a 1 in 1 million, it should say 1 in 1 million, not the 1 in 100,000 it says up there. I apologize for that typo. It's 1 in 1 million epinephrine. It's 1 cc of 1 in 1,000 injectable epinephrine put into a liter of normal saline. And we use an 18-gauge spinal needle and either a pressure bag or a Byron pump, a liposuction pump running on reverse to insufflate it. A few years ago, we did some work at our institution on trying to find a dose for phenylephrine. And the dose that we found for donor sites was 5 micrograms. But further work that we've done on burn eschar itself is 10 micrograms per cc is dose for phenylephrine to have a vasoconstrictive effect without having as much central effect. This is what a donor site looks like if you've injected appropriately with one of the vasoconstricting agents. It doesn't bleed at all. Right, and the eschar site will also have a similar effect if you're using either tourniquet or similar debridement techniques. From a fixation perspective, there are multiple different techniques for fixing a skin graft. There's the biological techniques. You can use one of the fibrin or thrombin analogs. You can inject these, either spray them on the wound using a slow set mode. That way you can apply the graft, move it into position, and then it will set and help adhere the graft down. You can inject it underneath the graft if you're using a sheet graft. Make sure that if you're doing that, you don't allow it to clump up underneath the graft, because if you do, then your adherence will decrease and your risk of having seromas or hematomas increases dramatically. There's been a number of different papers that have looked at the cost-benefit of this, and individuals have suggested that even though the fibrin analog and products can increase the cost, sometimes it decreases the cost in terms of the time in the operating room and graft take and so on. There's some preliminary work looking at the medical version of crazy glue. Other than the design, can anybody tell me the difference between the two pictures that are up there, one of which is medical and the other of which is just your standard crazy glue that you can get at Canadian Tire? Sorry, American Tire. Exactly. Yeah, the one on the left probably costs about $5 to $10. The one on the right, which is smaller, is exactly the same product, more or less. It's probably about $300 to $400, just because somebody wrote the name medical on it. If you take a look at the picture, I chose to put the term skin up there. So, you know, I think that that might be an alternative. There is some work, preliminary publications, on the use of the cyanoacrylate and trying to use it. The one thing that I've not included in this in terms of chemical or mechanical fixation is the use of a cold laser for fusion. It's experimental. I don't think there's a lot out there. Standard techniques that we use are staples. The problem with staples is that, number one, they're a problem to take out and they're painful, and number two, if you wait too long, they can cause scarring in and off themselves, and you really don't want to do that. So we use tape. At our institution, we take Hypofix tape, we cut it into strips that are about 6 to 9 inches long, and then we sterilize it. We get them to pack it as sterilized tape, so that on table, we can cut them into little strips that look like Steri-Strips, and then use them to hold different areas of skin graft in place. I learned this technique from Dr. Gibran and Heimbach in Harborview. We originally started with the sheet graft. I've expanded it to mesh graft, hands, feet, you know. It does take a little bit longer, so I tend to use it mainly for outpatient than inpatient care. And I use tincture of benzoin or Friar's balsam on the skin itself to increase the adherence of the tape to help decrease the risk that it might lift off. From a dressing perspective, use antimicrobial dressings. I won't go into belabor this, as you've heard from a couple of my colleagues about this. I'm not a fan of flamazine, sulvadine, silver sulfadiazine. I really dislike it. I find that it's potentially cytotoxic and decreases wound healing. We use the triple antibiotic. There are a number of different versions of this, polysporin, neosporin. There's different names. We like Adaptic. I think that it sticks less than Gelinet, and it has fewer of those strands that Gelinet leaves behind. But you can do this on Mepilex. You can do this on a number of different other products that will also act as a non-adherent barrier. Nanocrystalline silver or silver dressings, as you've heard, are in the uprise now with very good antimicrobial activity, and you can leave them on many of them for more than a day or two, which is fantastic. I tend to give prophylactic antibiotics systemically to my outpatient burn grafting patients. And I do this based on zero randomized controlled trials or strong evidence. I do it more out of fear than anything else, to be frank, because to me, the cost of giving somebody, Ansef or Keflex for 5 days is much less than the cost of losing a graft and the overall, including C. diff and everything else. I've yet to have any of my outpatients develop C. diff. It is not scientific, and I'm not trying to stand up here and tell you that it is. For sure, if it's larger wounds, contaminated, older patients, diabetic, obese, I will. If it's a 20-year-old who's got a small wound on their thigh, then I won't. I'll just give them perioperative dose. One of the big things that is coming in the future in terms of burn care is this idea that early ambulation following burn care is important. And historically, we've kept people in bed. We've said, great, if we're grafting them, you got 5 days bed rest. So this is published in the journal Burn Care by Dr. Nedlick and her group of OTs. And everyone's been concerned about trying to do foot grafts or leg grafts because of the risk of shear. So this is a patient that you can see his wound crosses his joint. We use tape to fix the graft. We put him in a compressive dressing. In the old days, this was a Nikitha paste boot or a zinc oxide boot, Pro-4, compress. There's all sorts of different versions of this that you can use. This is 5 days later. You can see the tape kind of like is a bit mushy and within the wound itself, but they tend to fall off. I leave the tapes in place until they fall off by themselves. Otherwise, because I use a tincture, sometimes if you get somebody who's overly aggressive, they can start to peel away at the graft itself. And these are other examples of feet that I've grafted that we've put the Pro-4 on and let them go home. Other examples of dressings to help reduce shear for abdomens. I don't use any adherence. I don't use any staples or tapes or anything else because I'm worried about the bowel underneath. I use a negative pressure device of some form, and depends on the day, depends on what my health region wants to buy and will allow me to spend money on. And the negative pressure devices are useful for unusual locations as well. This person did not ambulate on this one, by the way. This person heel walked on this wound. For donor sites, I use Xeroform. It's cheap. It's relatively easy for the patient to take care of. If it's a smaller wound, we'll do an op-site sandwich is what we call it. It's op-site that's laid down with a small hole cut in the corner. We put a 4x4 folded over the hole to help the drainage fluid be absorbed and put another op-site on top of that to trap that. Helps decrease the risk of infection and decreases the fluid trapment and underneath the op-site while giving it a moist wound environment. All right, post-operative teaching about the dressings. Make sure that the patients are aware of what's to be expected. Donor sites, because you infiltrate them with the saline and the epinephrine, will always ooze and will always ooze a serosanguinous kind of fluid. And patients get very upset when they see the bleeding coming out of their donor site. And they're like, oh my God, I'm bleeding to death. And if you have home care or other nursing that visits a patient at home and you're doing this as an outpatient, you need to make sure they're advised of it as well. Or you get 4 or 5 phone calls saying, oh my God, the patient's bleeding to death. And you're like, it's okay, you can calm down, it's not too bad. We need to talk about making sure that they know that they can ambulate, that they get appropriate analgesics for going home. And it's one of those things that, you know, in hospital, all of these patients end up on some hydromorph or oxycodone or something. At home, they get Tylenol 3s and NSAIDs, and they do fine. And very few of them call me to say, you know what, I'm in pain. I'm running out of time, so I'm just very quickly going to chat about analgesic and pre-medication. We've chatted, Dr. Palmieri's mentioned a number of these different things, but the use of things like oral transmucosal fentanyl and intranasal fentanyl have been studied, especially in pediatrics, and they can be short-acting, very effective analgesic for use in clinics. And oral ketamine has also been shown to be effective in these settings, decreasing visual analog scale reported pain. You do need to remember that depending on the individual with ketamine, sometimes you need to add benzo to help decrease the hallucinations that they get with that. One of the new agents that I think is going to be coming out in the next little while, we're investigating it at our center, is nitrous oxide that showed that there's decreased anxiety and decreased pain. It's been used in kids for a number of years. And there's a new inhaler type system where you get a metered dose so you can avoid the hypoxia and other complications you get with uncontrolled nitrous oxide. So we've talked about why we should care about ambulatory surgery, why we should consider moving towards it, the patient selection and how to do the pre-op planning, the operative technical considerations and the clinical management. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and open the floor to questions.